The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering troubleshooting and repair services for broken or problematic Macs, iPads, and iPhones, both in warranty and out. More information at TechServe.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Conflict and cooperation, conflict or cooperation. Much of what passes for news or episodes in the urgent story of human conflict around the world or the hopeful story of human cooperation to solve global problems. There's a big idea for this Friday. The unresolved conflicts in the Middle East reveal an apparent inability of nations to cooperate over what to do about refugees fleeing into Europe. Just yesterday, we reported how Croatia was responding to closed borders in Hungary by welcoming a few thousand Syrian refugees. In 24 hours, though, these few thousand have become a flood of perhaps 10,000, and Croatia now has reportedly closed its borders with Serbia, creating a stateless limbo for more people displaced by war. In this century, as we've noted many times, the failure of international institutions to prevent or resolve military conflicts has produced a refugee crisis numbering more than 60 million, to which we can add the more than 1.2 million new refugees from an insurgent war in Nigeria. The UN says most of them are fleeing the terrorist group Boko Haram. Most of them are children under the age of five, and at least a half million have been displaced in just the past 5 months. Is this unprecedented shift of population beyond the capacity of international cooperation, or can nations gradually mobilize to take care of the millions now on the move? For an assessment, we turn to Ryan Crocker, former U.S. ambassador to Iraq, Afghanistan, and Syria, now dean and executive professor at the George Bush School of Government and Public Policy at Texas A&M University. Ambassador, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you, John.
Mr. Ambassador, 20 former senior officials from the State Department, the National Security Council, the Department of Defense, among other agencies, have sent a letter to President Obama and congressional leaders, and they're asking for more money for resettling Syrian refugees in the United States and accepting up to 100,000 Syrian refugees. The current U.S. cap is at 70,000. Do you support this request?
I signed that letter and was very proud to do so. As you noted earlier, this is a global crisis. It is a crisis that very much involves the United States. It is not a European problem or an African problem or a Middle Eastern problem. It's a problem for all of us. And it is a problem that is only going to be effectively treated if the United States leads.
Drawing on your capacity as former U.S. ambassador to Iraq, Afghanistan, and Syria, your colleague Colin Powell once said, talking about the U.S. invasion of Iraq, if you break it, you own it. That's ancient history now. But I'm wondering if some of the thousands, perhaps tens of thousands of broken families making their way to Europe are owned in some sense by the U.S. invasion of Iraq, destabilizing the region, destabilizing Syria, leading to many of the problems that we are seeing, and that there is a moral dimension to the U.S. taking more of a role here.
I learned maybe two things in 40 years in the Foreign Service. The first is, be careful what you get into. The Middle East is a complicated place if you decide you're going to play in that court. And the second thing is, be just as careful what you propose to get out of. That disengagement can have consequences as great or greater than that initial engagement. And I would suggest to you that in Iraq, we were not careful going in 2003, and we were not careful coming out in 2011.
Is the president getting something wrong by being too careful in thinking about U.S. commitments on the military side and not being bold enough in thinking about U.S. responsibilities on the moral side, worried about getting involved in military conflict against ISIS in Syria without worrying about the global consequences of the refugees that we're seeing in Europe?
I again, would implore the president to realize that this is a moral imperative. It's also a national security imperative. However you define or describe it, you have to show leadership. In dealing with this refugee crisis, it does not require right now that anybody send in military divisions. It does require that we work with the Europeans and with others to see that refugees are dealt with humanely, and we need to lead by example.
There are reports now that the U.S. is ready to begin military-to-military talks with Russia about the situation in Syria. Does that amount to essentially a Russian-U.S. negotiated surrender to Bashar al-Assad, essentially allowing him to keep power, a real change in the regime change policy that the president was talking about just a few years ago?
The Russians have a policy in Syria. It's a dreadful policy from any standpoint, but it's coherent in its own terms. They're all in supporting Bashar al-Assad. We don't have a policy in Syria. So if we are going to talk to the Russians, I think we better have a policy first, so that you have a conversation that sounds something like President Obama telling President Putin that as you contemplate what you're going to do in Syria, I'm going to tell you what I'm doing. I'm going to impose a no-fly zone. The barrel bombs that have killed tens of thousands and have driven hundreds of thousands of others out of the country as refugees are going to stop. And by the way, I can impose that no-fly zone without using aircraft. I can do it with missiles. So think about what you're going to do. Maybe it's time for you and your thug friend Bashar to come to the table, and time for him to go, because we're coming in.
Ambassador Crocker, I heard the commander of CENTCOM on Capitol Hill talking about the possibility of safe zones for Syrians inside the areas of Iraq and Syria that are controlled by ISIS, on the border between ISIS-controlled territory and Kurdistan. And it seemed to me that both CENTCOM doesn't quite know where the administration is headed here, and that the notion of safe zones is a kind of a capitulation to ISIS, that apparently we've quietly agreed to allow ISIS to exist in that region. Do you see it that way?
I'm not quite sure what General Austin's concept of a safe zone is. To me, if a zone is to be truly safe, someone has to defend and protect it. That means boots on the ground. Is General Austin proposing that U.S. forces go in to secure a safe zone? If that's what we're talking about, that's a major shift in our policy. Syria is the problem from hell. You have ISIS and al-Qaeda on the one hand, and you have Bashar al-Assad on the other. You know, I think we have got to step up a campaign against both.
Ryan Crocker is former U.S. ambassador to Iraq, Afghanistan, and Syria. He's now dean and executive professor at the George Bush School of Government and Public Service at Texas A&M University. Thanks so much, Ambassador.
Thank you.
The very same questions about international cooperation and responsibility we were just discussing with Ambassador Crocker can also be asked about the capacity of nations to cooperate over the urgent consequences of another global problem, climate change. From the high-profile climate summits like the Kyoto Protocol that failed to bring nations together on global warming, to more recent regional efforts, this century will test whether nations can get serious about that urgent matter that knows no national borders and has consequences for all.
While the reality of climate change is not in doubt, I have to be honest, as the world watches us today, I think our ability to take collective action is in doubt right now.
That's President Obama speaking at the Copenhagen Climate Summit back in 2009. There's a new round of talks scheduled for December in Paris, and gradually there's been an understanding that international cooperation from the ground up may be a better model for success on global warming than the traditional summit approach. Joining us is Rebecca Lefton, Director of Policy and Research at Climate Advisors. That's a Washington, D.C. consulting firm. Rebecca, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So what do you think is going on? Are the relationships changing in this discussion of climate change? And is all cooperation local on climate change? You've seen China and the U.S. Getting together bilateral when they have a lot of things to disagree about, but maybe not so much on climate change. What do you think?
What we're seeing is a new level of cooperation between major emitting economies. And this is something that President Obama has been doing, especially in the second part of his administration. President Obama has really been elevating climate change into foreign policy with major emitting economies, including China and India and Brazil, because working with these countries that are some of the leading major emitters is really essential.
Here's Vice President Joe Biden at the U.S.-China Summit Leaders Conference in Los Angeles this month.
We share in common belief that the United States-Chinese relationship is critical to the peace and prosperity and absolutely essential to fight climate change.
Would you say, Rebecca, that if China and the United States continue to talk about these targets seriously, that it encourages cities to cooperate bilaterally in their own targets for improving the climates on their own streets?
Oh, absolutely. So Vice President Biden was speaking about the recent agreement between the U.S. and China where 30 cities in 30 Chinese and U.S. cities agreed to cooperate on climate change. And we're going to see more and more of these types of local level and regional cooperation between the U.S. and China and the U.S. and other countries on climate change. There are a lot of ways that cities can cooperate to share best practices, and cities are really invested in ensuring that they're going to be protected from the impacts of climate change, because that's where the impacts are really felt. They're felt at the local level.
Rebecca Lefton, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Rebecca Lefton, Director of Policy and Research at Climate Advisors, a Washington, D.C. climate consultancy firm, talking about what's at stake in the upcoming Paris Summit on Climate Change. As we think about the global political challenges for maintaining progress on climate change, we should note that really all climate change is local. Local in the vanished wildlife, the severe weather trends, the wildfire devastation being seen in the American West right now. It's a story that can be told in vanishing bird songs, silent rivers, and radically transformed sound pictures of places where ancient sounds of nature are crowded out by the sounds of human settlements. Have you ever thought about the background sound you would hear if you stripped away the noises you make in your own daily life? What's the background sound in your own audio portrait?
This is Jen in Austin, Texas. I actually leave my local NPR station on the radio all day. And when I have to leave, I keep it on so that my little dog can listen to it.
Brian Lara in WNYC.
And I think it makes her a little bit smarter every day.
My name is Colette Millard, and I'm calling from Morris, Minnesota. And the background noise in my world is fans from my unair-conditioned dorm room and my roommate groaning about the constant lack of Wi-Fi on our campus.
Boston says, my kids' incessant use of video games. From Pennsylvania, I work in a pharmaceutical lab, and the hum of the negative 70 degrees Celsius freezers is enough to lull even the most severe insomniac to sleep.
This is Nancy from Massachusetts. In the background right now, I'm listening to the strain of the engine and scraping noises of the bucket of a front loader in my crazy neighbor's yard. After a decade with this background noise, I'm moving back to the city. I'll be moving to a tree-lined street in a vibrant neighborhood that is much quieter than my little house in the country.
This is Will Brown from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. My soundtrack would be Donald Trump saying, I'm really, really rich on repeat all the time.
I'm really rich. 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 I'm really rich.
Statesboro, Georgia. I live out in the boonies of rural South Georgia, and when I step outside, besides a random car or a train off in the distance, I hear the symphony of nature. Bernie Krause, who we will speak to later this hour, knows that symphony very well.
These soundscapes are narratives of places. And we've got to pay some attention how important they are, not only to science, but also to culture. And it's kind of a Rosetta Stone, and we've just temporarily forgot the key. And we're learning about these things just now.
That's Bernie Krause, who, as the founder of the field of soundscape ecology, records the changing sounds of the wild. All that coming up here on The Takeaway. Pope Francis has called on European nations to put humanitarian principles ahead of national interests to confront the refugee crisis in the Middle East and Europe. Activists in the United States want to remind the Pope that internal politics and gridlock here have produced a humanitarian crisis for migrant families in America. 100 women, many of them undocumented immigrants, are walking 100 miles to Washington, D.C. this week to draw attention to America's broken immigration system and deliver a message for the Pope's visit to the U.S. Takeaway correspondent Todd Zwillick has been walking with these women in northern Maryland. Their sturdy new shoes, 20 miles into the trip, he says, will have a few more miles on them by the time they get inside the Beltway.
I'm standing alongside the Heritage Trail. This is an old abandoned railway bed that's now a recreational trail in rural Maryland. We're about 8 or 9 miles south of the Pennsylvania border. in the country. I'm with about 100 women, well, maybe about 100, it's hard to tell exactly, marching 100 miles from Pennsylvania all the way down to Washington, D.C. to meet Pope Francis when he's in town. These women, many of them are recent migrants themselves, many are undocumented, some are American citizens, but they're here, they say, to bring attention to the lives and the families of immigrants, to what they go through to get here, to their economic situations, and really many of them say just to their humanity.
I'm in pain, I'm tired, I'm exhausted, I miss my family, I miss my son, I miss my husband, but this is our suffering, this is what we carry, this is our story. So if we don't show it, they're never gonna see it and they're never gonna hear it. That's why I'm walking 100 miles. My name is Esmeralda Dominguez. I'm from Denver, Colorado. I was born in Mexico. I'm an American citizen born outside the U.S. My husband is undocumented. I have a special needs child, and I'm also cancer survivor for stomach, and I'm facing bone cancer right now.
Is there a danger now that your husband will be deported? Is there a danger that you'll be separated?
Yes. He's my caretaker. He's my everything. He's the one that provides, you know, care for me while I'm home, you know, doing my chemotherapy. He's, you know, he's my main support. He takes care of not just me, but my child. He also, you know, he's an active member of the community. So it is, you know, danger. It's affecting me because without him, I don't have anybody else to turn to.
You're getting paid. People should open their hearts, like the Pope said, and understand that immigrants are human beings that deserve to be treated with dignity and respect. And we are just looking for an opportunity, and we just want to live in peace with our families.
My name is Rosy Carrasco. I'm from Chicago, and I'm part of the Organized Communities Against Deportations, OCAD.
I was told that you're undocumented yourself.
Yes, sir.
You're not afraid of having a clash with the authorities, or are you?
I learned from my daughters that you do not have to be afraid. You have to be strong. You have to let people know that we are here, that we are part of this community, and we are living here. There must be a solution. Instead of hate, should be open the doors to immigrants that already are living here. We already are working. We have our houses. We have our children, we have our families.
Mi nombre es Ana Cañengues y vivo en Utah. Para mí fue muy difícil tomar.
I've lived here for 13 years. Well, more than 13 years. For me, it was really hard to make that decision of migrating, especially because my children were very young, but it was what was necessary because I couldn't make enough money back in my country for their food. So after 8 years that I was able to finally be with my children again, and I thought I was finally gonna be able to enjoy this country, we began a new stage in our lives because we entered into the immigration system. When I had to leave to Mexico to look for my two children, and I was fighting for them because they were in a detention center for children in Mexico. And when I was able to have them back with me and we started our way up here, we were lost in the desert with my children for 3 days, and I had to call Border Patrol to rescue us. And this is when a horrible nightmare began, and this odyssey of having to fight for 3 years against deportation.
And is everyone safe now from deportation? Are you in a more comfortable place now?
No sé cómo.
So I don't know how to respond right now. I'm a little bit more at peace because of the announcement by President Obama in November about executive action. It's the only thing that could save me from deportation.
You walked 3 days in the desert with your children. I've been asking everybody else if they're prepared to walk 100 miles through a nice shady forest. I think for you, this walk is nothing.
Sí, yeah, so I know that in that moment it was really hard. And the reason why I did it was to make my life and my children's lives safer. But now that I'm doing this pilgrimage, I walk with a lot of faith and a lot of hope. Because now I have some very powerful reasons. And in this pilgrimage, in search of a lot of dignity and in search of making sure that our stories get to the Pope in Washington, D.C.
It seems that for you, the way this debate turns out in this country could actually decide, perhaps, whether you and your family stay or have to go.
Absolutamente. Yeah, absolutely. And this is why we're here. This is why I'm here. For my family, for myself, for the 11 million undocumented people, and for all the women that are suffering because of this broken immigration system.
Takeaway correspondent Todd Zwillick reporting from Northern Maryland, just south of the Pennsylvania border. To see photos of the women on their march, visit thetakeaway.org. Fundamentalist cult leader Warren Jeffs was sent to prison a decade ago for transgressions he committed as head of the Mormon Fundamentalist Church of the Latter-day Saints, the FLDS. It was believed his domination over a community of intensely faithful followers had finally ended. Jeffs' plural marriages and the sexual bondage he inflicted on young women may have ended with a prison sentence, but Jeffs' less familiar family business and global corporate ventures not only survived, they have grown while he was behind bars.
You need to be perfectly obedient to all the church leaders, and you know that is what they beat into us every single day of our lives. Anyone that stepped outside of the bounds of what he set for everyone, we were targeted.
Sam Brower is a private investigator who spent nearly a decade investigating FLDS leader Warren Jeffs. He wrote about the investigation for his book, Prophets Pray. And that investigation has become a documentary film produced and directed by Amy Berg. Brower explains how Jeffs commands his flock to function like a smiling army who bid low for business contracts and simply won't back down.
One of their main mantras is, you know, keep sweet no matter what. And Warren Jeffs is anything but sweet. He's a child molester. He's a child rapist. You know, he does all the same things as a mob boss does, just in a different way. He just uses his religious tenets to hook the people, and he's able to pull off his crimes and illegal activity.
When did you first begin to understand that Warren Jeffs was more like a mob boss than a traditional charismatic religious leader?
Well, when I first started, it was kind of a simple investigation, but I started delving more into the business aspects of it and how he operated and who was running what and what the businesses were. And I started tracing down shelf corporations, shell corporations, and seeing how that CEOs and presidents and officers of these corporations are also intermingled with the city governments and with the marshal's office and how they all just kind of intertwine. I mean, it's so complex, it's really hard to make the connections. They've really done a good job of making it hard to trace.
Who are Warren Jeffs' workers, and what do they make?
They are children. I mean, he uses the children that are his followers to harvest pecans and lay concrete and build massive structures. And, I mean, some of them are 7-8-year-old kids.
And what products might a listener have used that could have come from this, you know, huge venture.
Military bases all over the country have been upgraded, infrastructure remodeled and redone through FLDS corporations. The gun parts for North American arms are made or were made by FLDS companies. The Salt Lake Tribune did a story and counted about 70 different Walmarts that hired a company called Phase Concrete, an FLDS company. And each one of those jobs is worth between $3 and $4 million. So we're talking millions of dollars a month coming into their coffers. And the thing is, just like any mob or organized crime syndicate, they have the best, most unscrupulous attorneys money can buy that protect them and insulate them from the rest of the world, and they're able to pull that off.
Jeffs is behind bars. He was unable, I mean, you had no access to him. Is he out of business, Amy?
He's more powerful in prison than he was on the outside. And the longer he stays in prison, the more his followers believe that everything he says in his prophecies is actually true, that he has been taken away.
What control does he have inside of a prison?
I mean, it's blind faith. He continues to issue prophecies. His brothers are afraid of him, and because if there is a dissension between the brothers, then Warren might pull the plug on the whole operation and possibly order a mass suicide. So there is this massive fear in the community.
What's the response of people who have used these corporations to the tactics and the possibility that they might have been duped in some way?
Government entities have responded by saying, well, they're low bidder. And, you know, we have certain procedures and they qualified. They're able to get all the insurance they need and licensing they need, and they were the low bidder, so we used them. And, of course, they sneak child labor in. They use it every possible way they can, and they may not be right there on the job site, but maybe they're driving trucks somewhere or they're doing things in the background. But, you know, there really hasn't been much of a backlash to the end users.
What do the children of Warren Jeffs grow up to be?
Well, many of them have left in the recent years, but the blind faith continues as they get older and they have more children, and it's a cycle.
And what did you see in the characters that you were able to observe?
I saw people that are really trying to integrate into modern society, but they have this kind of they feel judged. They're between two worlds in a way. So it's a long process, I think, for somebody to recover from all the brainwashing that and all the things that they've been party to.
Is he growing or shrinking his operation?
I would say neither one. He's morphing his operation. He's divided the church into two different groups now. One's called the United Order. The other one we just call the Repentance Church. You know, it kind of creates this competition. So when it comes to, say, a mass suicide or something like that, each one is trying to outdo the other and to prove their loyalty and their obedience.
Sam Brower and Amy Berg, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sam Brower spent nearly a decade investigating FLDS leader Warren Jeffs, and Amy Berg is the director of Prophets Pray, a new documentary based on Brower's book. Prophets Pray is in theaters today. Up next, you'll hear the sounds of our changing, warming planet from a soundscape ecologist. But from Glenwood Landing, New York, my background noise, you say, is 1,200 middle school students.
Hi, this is Jonathan from Joplin, Missouri. I live in the country, and my house is surrounded by oak trees. It's a windy day today, so all day I've been hearing acorns hit my roof and roll down to the ground.
Background noises all over our listener community at 8778-MY-TAKE. Much more at thetakeaway.org.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 17,000 skills like genetics, graphic design, and golf. Curious.com. Grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
International cooperation on challenges like global warming require a common understanding and appreciation of the changing planet in a language everyone can understand. pictures of stranded polar bears and flooded Pacific islands, satellite pictures of shrinking glaciers and vanishing ice can sharpen and clarify the urgency of the problem for all to see. But sometimes sound is worth a million pictures in telling the story of a changing planet. This roar is from a newsreel made back in the 1930s, and it's all that's left of what was once the largest waterfall in North America, Celilo Falls on the mighty Columbia River. It went silent in 1957 when it was submerged by the rising waters behind the Dalles Dam. That silence symbolized the obliteration of a gathering place for Native Americans that was a center of fishing, culture, and cooperation for thousands of years. A sound and a people gone. Bernie Krause recorded this soundscape of a habitat that may soon disappear. He's invented the field of soundscape ecology to tell the story and sound of a changing planet, a symphony, he says, being silenced as sounds, like players in a grand orchestra, vanish from the wild.
In 1983, I was on this mission for the California Academy of Sciences to record in Kenya, and I had picked a time of year to record in Africa that I thought was going to be very rich with sound. And it didn't really occur to me that seasons played an important role, because most of the recordings that have been done to that point were single species recordings. So we went out and we kind of deconstructed the natural world in an abstract way. And our missions always were, as ornithologists, to go out and record and separate out these individual sounds so we could have the numbers and put them in our archives. Well, when I first started working on this in 1968, what I thought was that there was much more information in the complete recordings rather than just individual birds or mammals or insects. So that's how I got into this, and that's how I began to hear it.
And as you travel around the world, and I've traveled around the world, it's striking the differences in what you hear at night when nobody's talking and when you walk outside or when you're in a tent just listening to crickets in one season, the winter silence, the howling of coyotes. What do these soundscapes mean to you?
Most recently, the thesis that we've come up with is that these sounds occur, particularly where we live, for instance. I live in an area that's a temperate zone, and this is actually the beginning of the year. This is the beginning of Darwin's timeline of evolution, if you want. This time of year, we hear just insects, crickets and insects. That's all we hear at night. And around December, after the rains are established, when it's a normal season, of course, we begin to hear frogs. So we hear the insects first, and then we hear the amphibians and reptiles. And then in February or March, we hear the birds come into the chorus. And then we hear, finally, the mammals, the coyotes, the foxes, and different critters that are wild and vocalized around here. So it follows exactly that timeline of evolution, and it's incredible how it works out.
And the stories of your soundscapes over time tell some fairly provocative stories of humanity's impact on the world. I want to play this minute-long set of clips that you recorded in the same place. Tell me about the place where you decided to record this, Sugarloaf State Park.
Sugarloaf State Park is about a 20-minute drive from where my wife and I live, and I've been recording there since 1993. So we've seen the changes over time. And this recording, it's a spring soundscape, a dawn chorus at sunrise when the birds are their most active in the spring. This is the first one recorded in 2004.
Beautiful.
And the second in 2009, 5 years later. And the bird density is beginning to drop off at this point, partly because of global warming, we think. And here's 2014, 3 years into the drought.
Wow.
Wait. In 2015.
It started? I'm listening to it?
Yeah.
It's like silence.
No birdsong.
Very little silent spring.
It's silent springtime.
What does that tell you?
Well, I mean, it tells me that these critters are under a lot of stress. I mean, we have a bird feeder outside of our house, and we have a lot of birds showing up, but there hasn't been a peep coming from them, not a single sound coming from these birds.
Tell me about some other places that you've collected for your various collections. I'm thinking particularly of your sound collections from Sumatra.
Well, Sumatra is important because when we recorded there in the early 90s, we really captured a lot of Aceh province. Aceh province, if you remember, was the site of the 2004 tsunami, and it wiped out a lot of the coastal area. But the people had to rebuild their houses, so they went back up into the forest, and they began to cut down the trees to rebuild their houses and also to use the wood for firewood. Well, those forests were protected. They were part of an area that orangutans still lived, and the clouded leopard and so on. When I recorded there, I actually captured the soundscape when it was quite alive. I haven't been back to get the result since people have begun to change that habitat. But I have to tell you that those that we have recorded, both in Costa Rica and also in the Sierra Nevada mountains, not too far from San Francisco, where we have had before and after examples of habitats changing, the changes are radical, even when we were doing just selective logging.
That's the sound of the Osa Peninsula in Costa Rica before and after logging in the late 1980s. Bernie Krause, have we lost our connection to the soundscapes in our urban 21st century life?
My impression of it is that we're kind of being screamed at by the sounds of the natural world to slow up a little bit and take a deep breath and stop utilizing and plundering these resources that are so fragile. And we've got to start thinking about how we're doing that.
Bernie Krause, thanks so much for speaking with us.
You're very welcome, John.
Bernie Krause is the founder of the field of soundscape ecology. His new book, Voices of the Wild, Animal Songs, Human Din, and the Call to Save Natural Soundscapes, came out last month. Hey, take this with you this weekend. A place that doesn't have to worry about global warming is Pluto, according to the latest NASA pictures from the New Horizons spacecraft. They are stunner images. They show glaciers growing and moving in Earth-like cycles. The high-resolution pictures show Pluto's surface as a place one can actually imagine visiting. Check the pictures out. Starting a campfire there at 369 degrees below zero might be challenging, though. I bet it's quiet, kind of like dead air, something you never hear here on The Takeaway. Give us your take. Tell us a story at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.